Hello, my name's Dave Emery. We're visiting with Dick Russell, the author of The Man Who Knew Too Much, one of the most voluminous and one of the very best books about the assassination of President Kennedy. It deals with the Byzantine intelligence career of Richard K. Snagel, an individual who had worked for U.S. intelligence, probably Soviet intelligence as well, and who had infiltrated the milieu that was plotting against President Kennedy, ostensibly on behalf of U.S. intelligence, but perhaps on behalf of Soviet intelligence in order to prevent the assassination, which Soviet intelligence had apparently found out about. That is the impending assassination. Dick, you were talking about the last stages of your relationship with Richard K. Snagel. You had begun a relationship with him, a professional relationship, in 1975 that had been interdicted. You had not spoken to him in a long time. You wrote this huge and excellent book about Richard K. Snagel, and also, I should add, of the rest of the elements that figure into the Kennedy assassination story. He had not apparently received not only the book, but your correspondence with him, and several years after the book was published, or a couple of years after the book was published, was still unaware that the book had been published. Could you pick up the story at that point, please?
Yeah, well, I said, you know, I'd really like to see you again in Los Angeles, and he said, well, I said, I'm coming out there shortly and working on an article and would like to get together and, you know, hear what you think of the book if you have a chance to pick it up. And he agreed to do that. And when I went to L.A. And tried to reach him, I didn't have a phone number for him, just a P.O. box. And he called and I was out and said that he would not be able to see me. I then got a message on my machine back in Boston that he was told not to see me by whom he did not say. When I was in L.A., I still hoped to sit down with him again. And then in the fall of 1995, I went to Washington to speak at a conference of the Coalition on Political Assassinations. And the Assassination Records Review Board, which is currently reviewing under mandate of Congress all of the existing records on the assassination, was there. And I spoke with them about Snagel. They were aware of my book, and they finally decided, yeah, okay, this is important. We are going to issue a subpoena for this man's records and try to see him. So they did, and I got a call, I think it was a Friday, from a journalist in Los Angeles telling me that Richard K. Snagel had been found dead in his home in the Echo Park section of L.A., and apparently had been dead for a few days. His body was discovered on the very day that the subpoena from the review board arrived. So, needless to say, I was rather upset about this. Felt, and you know, perhaps my talking to the review board and talking about him again publicly may have contributed to this. I didn't know. I spent considerable time looking into it, trying to see what had happened. I was in touch with members of his family, and an autopsy was performed, and it was determined that there had been a heart attack as the cause of death. His body was then cremated, so that's all we have, is that autopsy report. Of course, many of your listeners may be aware that, you know, one can induce heart attacks. It's not impossible. Intelligence agencies have been doing it. The Soviets know how to do it. The Americans know how to do it. So I would class his death as one of those mysterious deaths, of which there are many in the history of the years since the Kennedy assassination. And I don't know at this point if we will ever know the full story of what he knew. He had indicated to me that if he died, when he died, that he'd made arrangements for certain information to come out. It never has, and I think I would be aware if somebody had it. So at this point, I'm not hopeful that we'll ever know too much more than what I put in my book, except maybe there'll be some additional information about him released in the files that are coming out.
It certainly would be great if some of that information did come out, but again, I don't share your optimism, or I share your pessimism, I should say, in that particular regard. We should also note in passing that intelligence agencies, and now quite a few private groups, have the capability of using toxic agents which will simulate any number of natural, apparently natural causes of death and then disappear without a trace.
That's true.
It's one of the things that makes researching a political assassination within the context of the intelligence community extremely difficult. People do die of heart attacks, strokes, cancers, etc., yet there are Freedom of Information Act documents indicating that all of those modes of apparently natural death can be simulated by toxic agents that are deployed by intelligence services. Back in the background of Richard Case Nagel, one of the organizations that he operated for in the Far East, and this will be a jumping-off point for a discussion of some of the international right-wing connections, you discuss an apparently very powerful, although largely unrecognized, military intelligence unit called Field Operation Intelligence. Could you tell us more about that?
Yes, Field Operations Intelligence, or FOI, was a top secret arm of military intelligence in the Far East during the 1950s and maybe later. Nagel was attached to this unit. It was involved in political assassinations and counterfeiting money. He was stationed in Japan and in South Korea with this unit, and I'd only seen one other reference to it in anything that had ever been published, and that was just a sort of an obscure footnote in a book called The Secret War by Sanche de Grammont that came out in 1962, which indicated FOI had had something to do with the Berlin Tunnel operation back in the 50s. But nobody ever had said anything about it other than that, and I was able to track down a man in his 80s, Colonel John Stanley, who had commanded FOI back in the 50s. So both he and one of his subordinates did verify its existence. And Miguel wrote about FOI at some length in his filings in his lawsuit against the military, the U.S. Court of Claims. So it was a real organization. It was very shady. It was involved with South Korean intelligence operatives as well, all in operations directed against the communists, Russia, China, North Korea, and so on.
One of the people that you discuss as being heavily involved with covert intelligence operations in the Korean conflict and in the Pacific theater, and one of the individuals whose names winds through your discussion of the man who knew too much is Major General Charles Willoughby, a name that is not very well known to people, but an individual who has figured very prominently in the history of America in the second half of the century. Could you tell us more about him?
Yeah, Charles Willoughby was the chief of intelligence for General Douglas MacArthur, both in World War II and the Korean War period. He had been born in Heidelberg, Germany, and his real name, original name, was Sheppy Wiedenbach. And he had, you know, come to the United States with his parents when he was young, risen to prominence in the military. And he's been written about, although no full biography has ever been done on him, but in a number of books, and it's very, very clear from other authors who have looked at his life and from the files that I got out of the MacArthur Library that that this man was indeed a fascist, that he had been very close to people like Franco in Spain, very involved with the international right wing all over the world, particularly in Germany as well as in the Far East. And it's a strange story. I'll tell you this story, which I mentioned briefly in the book. Back in 1975, when I first started writing about the assassination, and I had a piece in the Village Voice, a big cover story, I got a letter, an anonymous letter, from someone who said that I should examine the career of a man named Sheppy Wiedenbach, and that this was really the mastermind behind the Kennedy assassination. Well, at the time, I thought this letter was some kind of kook or something. I mean, Sheppy Wiedenbach was a very weird name. I'd never heard of Charles Willoughby. And it was only many years later when I began further research into what we're talking about now that I came to discover that Sheppy Wiedenbach was Willoughby's original name. So unfortunately, I never followed up with the opportunity to put a classified ad in the Village Voice and continue communicating with this fellow, whoever he was, but obviously it was somebody who knew something.
Again, Willoughby, nay Wiedenbach, was an individual who was in charge of military intelligence for Douglas MacArthur throughout World War II and well into the Korean War, and he was an ardent admirer of Francisco Franco and had a lot of connections. MacArthur himself described him as my very own fascist and our Junker general on two occasions. You discuss in The Man Who Knew Too Much a number of MacArthur staffers or former MacArthur staffers whose names wind through the milieu of American reactionary politics and the Kennedy assassination investigation as well. People like William Potter Gale, General Bonner Fellers, Albert Wiedemeyer. Could you tell us something about this MacArthur milieu that you that winds through your narrative?
Yeah, well, there was apparently a whole crew of military guys, many of whom retired, who had very extreme right-wing views. Interestingly, a lot of them hooked up, including Willoughby, with a mysterious group headquartered in Pennsylvania, Shikshini, Pennsylvania, called the Shikshini Knights of Malta. And through this organization, which was set up by a guy who had been very high up, I think, in Hitler's Germany, originally, they stayed in contact, and not too much is known about them to this day. There's another group called the Knights of Malta, which was Catholic in orientation, which included a lot of, you know, big intelligence people also. But the Shikshini Knights was an offshoot. It was something else. It didn't have a direct ties with the Vatican or anything. And Willoughby and a lot of these guys were part of it. And so in the book, I trace sort of the connections between people like William Potter Gale out in California, who was very involved with the Minutemen and Cuban exiles, and their ties to Willoughby, and Willoughby's ties in turn to some Cuban exiles whose names have come up as having known something about the assassination. I mean, Willoughby was a very well-connected guy. He was in correspondence with Alan Dulles, quite a bit in the 50s and 60s. When Dulles was head of the CIA, he was very close to Hargis, Billy James Hargis, who was a right-wing evangelist. I mean, there's a whole network that also extends overseas into Germany and elements of Hitler's Germany that had gone on to actually work for the CIA, as I'm sure you're aware. After the war, the agency and the military recruited a number of Hitler's top intelligence people, including Reinhard Gehlen, to work for them.
Yeah, and the milieu of Willoughby and many of the organizations which overlap each other also overlap the Gehlen organization and related elements. One of the things that you discuss in connection with Willoughby and Dulles is Willoughby's recommendation, and apparently something that was implemented, that American service people and their families overseas stationed in Germany specifically could be targeted for psychological warfare and converted to the far right-wing cause.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that book came up at a meeting in April of 1963 of a lot of these folks in Washington, D.C., where Willoughby spoke. Another of the speakers was Edward Hunter. Hunter was supposedly a journalist, but in fact, he's the guy who coined the term brainwashing back during the Korean War period, and when all fingers were pointed at the North Koreans and the communists as, you know, having come up with these new techniques that could mess up people's minds. But in fact, Hunter was working for the CIA all the time as a propaganda specialist, and continued to be operating this way right up to the time of this meeting in 1963. And so you had this element, too, coming into this milieu.
Now, this was the anti-communist liaison?
Yes, it was called the anti-communist liaison. There were a number of groups under different banners that came together, and, of course, they were all rabidly anti-communist and extreme right-wing positions, hated Kennedy, hated Castro, thought we should nuke the Soviet Union, all these kind of things.
One of the things that we should note is not only were these groups right-wing and in many cases fascist with a capital F, dating back to Nazi Germany in some cases, but these organizations also overlapped, although were not coterminous, with elements of the national security establishment, meaning the military and intelligence community. I think that's an important point to underscore, because these weren't just, quote, right-wingers, unquote, or even, quote, fascists, unquote, but actually had connections to very powerful elements of the military and intelligence community. You analyze a number of different organizations which overlap each other and, in turn, the national security establishment, and which, in turn, intersect with and comprise an international sort of fascist underground. One of the organizations that Willoughby was heavily involved with and that fits into this mosaic is something called the ICDCC, the International Committee for the Defense of Christian Culture. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, let me try and remember now. There are so many different groups I wrote about in this book, and it's been a few years. And I don't think I knew too much about that at the time, but... It seems like the International Committee for the Defense of Christian Culture was eventually run by the son of H.L. Hunt, the Nelson, oil man.
Nelson Bunker, right?
That would be Nelson Bunker Hunt.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in close touch with Willoughby, and there are letters that exist in the MacArthur archives going back to... the 60s and the 50s, and letters, correspondence between the Hunts and Willoughby. There was one, for example, in 1967, and we can talk more about the Hunt family in Texas, but there was a letter in 67 that when the Garrison investigation was going on and looked like it might point a finger to the Hunts as having had something to do with the assassination, they were writing back and forth to Willoughby about finding a way to put it out that a comparison between Soviet assassinations of the past and Lee Harvey Oswald, and specifically a case involving a guy named Bogdan Stashinsky, who murdered a guy named Stefan Bandera, coincidentally, most likely, on the very day that Oswald arrived in the Soviet Union back in 1959.
Bandera, by the way, a Ukrainian fascist who was heavily involved with this intelligence and international milieu we're talking about.
Yes, he was.
By the way, for listeners who'd like to fill in details about the ICDCC, there's a brilliant essay, as yet unpublished, I believe, by Peter Dale Scott, the brilliant Berkeley researcher, called The Dallas Conspiracy, and also Government Documents in the JFK Assassination. Listeners can contact Spitfire, the tape duplication service that stocks my tapes, and I've read long sections of that, including the ICDCC, in RFA 37, specifically the August 2nd and August 30th of 1992 installments of that. And listeners can fill in some of the details concerning this. This was, by the way, in the interest of time, an international milieu which involved American reactionaries like Nelson Bunker Hunt, people like Fritz Kramer and veterans of Third Reich intelligence associated with the Reinhard Gehlen milieu, as well as outright SS, ex-SS men like Theodor Oberland are involved with this milieu. Willoughby was heavily involved with the ICDCC, was he not?
Yes, he was. Yeah, he was one of the founders of it, I believe, and was one of a number of these groups that he was in touch with, and they had meetings overseas. I think there was one in the fall of 63 that Theodor Oberlander, who had been a leading Nazi in the past, was involved with, that took place in Europe. And so Willoughby and the Hunt family were very close to all these people.
One of the organizations, now again, we're talking about a series of organizations which overlap each other but are not coterminous with each other, and which are international in scope, at least to a certain extent, and which also overlap, though are not coterminous with, elements of military of the military and the intelligence community in this and in other countries. It's one of the things that makes this a very complex story. One of these overlapping organizations, another organization that touched both Willoughby and the Hunts, is something that is called CUSA, or Conservatism USA, and that figures in the scenario of the shooting shooting at General Edwin Walker.
That's right. In putting this book together, I came up with some very new information about the Walker shooting, and there's no way to verify it, but I was told that CUSA, which was a sort of a youth, right-wing youth organization that had been started in Germany by a guy named Larry Schmidt.
He actually recruited from within the ranks of U.S. service persons stationed in Munich, right?
Yeah, he was. He was in Munich, and then he came to Dallas around the same time Oswald did in the fall of 1962. And according to what I was told, not by Nagel, but by another guy who had been security man for the, his name was Brad Anger, and he had worked for the Hunts, I think, in that particular time. And what he said was that the Walker shooting was actually the work not only of Oswald, who was involved in it, but Oswald in tandem with Larry Schmidt of CUSA, a right-wing group, and his brother.
He was Volkmar Schmidt, wasn't it?
It wasn't Volkmar Schmidt. It was Larry Schmidt. Volkmar Schmidt was another fellow who knew Oswald in 1963, but it was Larry Schmidt that was with CUSA.
Volkmar was not Larry's brother.
No.
Okay, same last name, but not related.
Same last name, but a different Schmidt.
All righty. Larry Schmidt had an interesting political idol, I guess you could say.
His idol, I believe, was Charles Willoughby.
Well, what you did write in The Man Who Knew Too Much is actually his political role model was Joseph Goebbels.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, he knew Willoughby, but Goebbels was the political role model, who had been, of course, the propaganda minister for Adolf Hitler.
Sort of six of one, half a dozen of the other, actually. But it just depends on whether you want a Latin or Teutonically oriented fascist. But again, we should note this, because conservatism is really not what this was about. I have a lot of respect for a true conservative, although I would disagree with many of their points. But this Joseph Goebbels was not a conservative, and this was his idol.
That's right.
This was the organization that, according to your information, was involved in the attempted shooting against Edwin Walker.
Right, and exactly why they did that, the brother, Larry Schmidt's brother, had worked as a chauffeur for Walker. And there was some falling out and bad blood, and Walker was in kind of a strange position at the time in the eyes of the far right. He was considered too kind of crazy. He was hospitalized in the fall of 62 before he was shot at. And in fact, I interviewed Walker. He died a few years ago, but I interviewed him twice, and the second time was over the phone. And I got talking to him about the Schmidt brothers, and he said that he believed too and had been told that it was not only Oswald, but Larry Schmidt and his brother who'd been involved in the shooting attempt on him. Now, that raises a lot of interesting questions, okay? If Oswald was on the far left and the Schmidts were on the far right, how did they end up working together? Did somebody put them together? What was really going on here?
One of the most interesting things about the shooting at Edwin's the attempt to shoot Edwin Walker was that this information was supposedly surfaced to the Warren Commission in early December of 1963, and yet it was published in a Nazi newspaper in Germany, the Deutsche Nationalzeitung und Soldatenzeitung, on November 29th, five days before Marina supposedly disclosed this to the world. I don't think you have to be Sherlock Holmes to figure out there's something dreadfully wrong with that scenario.
And the newspaper that printed it was a very far-right newspaper in Munich, and it's always been a big question how they got that information.
The paper actually had several former SS men and veterans of Goebbels' propaganda ministry on its editorial board. Gerhard Fry, by the way, the editor, was one of the funding conduits for German money that went to Vladimir Zhirinovsky just a few years back.
Amazing.
One of the interesting things about the Hunt milieu is that it also intersects this international reactionary or fascist milieu. You discuss an organization called the AVG, the American Volunteer Group, and you speculate about a European counterpart which overlaps the Galen ABN milieu called Der Bird, or the Nightingale.
Right. Yeah, the Hunts had connection with those various groups, and there was a memo that surfaced some years back. Paul Rothermel, who was the Hunt's security man at the time, had sent a memo to a journalist about the AVG, the American Volunteer Group, and they were drawing on the ranks of the far right. And according to Rothermel, Nelson Bunker Hunt, and this was in the mid-60s, planned to form this paramilitary group for political purposes and get a certain type of gas gun from Europe, which would kill people and make their deaths appear to be heart attacks. And Rothermel said Nelson Hunt had set up a similar organization in Europe known as Der Bird, and that it had taken several assignments from the CIA.
You mentioned also that, although perhaps not coterminous, again, a word we've used a lot, that this Nightingale may have overlapped some of the Galen-related Hitler intelligence alumni that we've already touched on.
That's right. It was a European emigre group, and Willoughby had been involved with it, used it. And there was a group of Russian emigres in Dallas, which had similar viewpoints on the world, and they were the ones who first took the Oswalds under their wing in the summer of 62 when Lee and Marina came back from the Soviet Union.
You mentioned that some of the... Willoughby, by the way, was very close to Reinhard Galen, the Hitler intelligence chief who jumped to U.S. intelligence at the end of the war. You mention a number of names that run through this international milieu, a reactionary or fascist milieu, and which in turn were connected with white Russian reaction against the Soviet Union and worked for intelligence for Nazi Germany and then the United States. Organizations like the ITS or Solidarists, the ABN or Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, an umbrella group called the WACCFL, the World Anti-Communist Conference for Freedom and Liberation, which later became the WACL. And you mentioned names like Spas Rakin, Peter Gregory, Ilya Mamontov, Igor Voshinin, George de Morenshield, all names that run through history and also names which run through an international underground, which may very well have been involved with the assassination. Given the fact that we've only got 3 or 4 minutes, could you perhaps touch on this group's handling of Oswald, even from the time that he got back from the Soviet Union?
Well, the man who met Oswald at the boat when he came back from the Soviet Union was Spas T. Rakin. Now, I interviewed him on the phone. It all seems relatively innocuous, but Rakin was the Secretary General of the ABN, which was one of these far-right groups. Why was he the one who came to meet the Oswalds when they returned? When Oswald went to Dallas, Fort Worth area that summer of 62, as I said, the Russian emigres who had took the Oswalds under their wing were people who had many of these kind of connections. George de Morenshield, very mysterious figure. I interviewed him twice. He died an alleged suicide just as he was about to be interviewed by the House Committee on Assassinations back in 1977. And de Morenshield was very close to Oswald. He was 30 years older than Oswald was. He was very good friends for some unknown reason. De Morenshield is somebody whose ties seem to cut across everywhere. He had connections to the CIA. He'd traveled all over the world. He'd been suspected of being both a communist and a fascist agent at different times in his life. He was one of those mystery figures that I think took to his grave a number of secrets about Lee Harvey Oswald and the Kennedy assassination.
And in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, Lee Harvey Oswald, the Oswalds, I should say, both before and after the assassination, obviously after the assassination it was Marina and not Lee, but they were actually in the hands of this anti-communist extremist milieu, many elements of which had fled the Soviet, had fled Tsarist Russia and had worked for Third Reich intelligence and then U.S. intelligence.
Right. I mean, you know, Marina didn't speak much English, hardly at all, So her interpreter was were people from these various organizations, and you know, Marina has described herself to me as being like a zombie in those days. She did say when I interviewed her too over the phone that she did remember being taken to a building. This is something that one of H.L. Hunt's former employees had told me. To meet with H.L. Hunt for some reason that she couldn't remember why after the assassination. She was taken in an elevator up to this office, and she said, I went in, and she couldn't remember really what they talked about or what it was all about, but for some reason the Hunt family wanted to see her, and of course they had ties to all these people.
One person that you mentioned, and this will be our point of departure because we are virtually out of time, you mentioned a fellow named Joseph Adams Miltier, who was an attendant at the Congress of Freedom. Could you tell us briefly about the Congress of Freedom? We only have about 30 seconds left.
Congress of Freedom was a Southern-based group, and Joseph Miltier, and this is on record too, had warned or talked about an informant. Willie Somerset said this, talked about an impending assassination of the president. He's going to be shot from a sixth floor, I don't think he said sixth floor, but from a high window as a motorcade went by, and And Miltier's group definitely had connections to all these people as well.
And we've been speaking with Dick Russell, the author of The Man Who Knew Too Much. For Dick Russell, my name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.